Hi there, and welcome to the Skylight Books author reading series. If you'd like to learn more about us and our many upcoming author events, please visit skylightbooks.com, where you can browse our inventory, buy books, and join our Friends with Benefits Club. You can also follow us on Twitter, Tumblr, and Facebook. To speak to a real live bookseller like me, please call 323-660-1175. Thanks for your support, and enjoy.
We have Jamie over. Over, right? Okay. His writing has appeared in The Rumpus, Noon, Black, The Baltimore City Paper, Lady Churchill's Rosebud, Wristlet, Port.Man.2, that you say it, and Body Literature. As a screenwriter, he's worked in both film and television, and he has a script on the blacklist and was nominated for a Pushcart Prize, most of it on Bicycle. Currently, he's a writer on the Netflix series The OA, and Dr. Benjamin Franklin's Dream America is his first novel. And joining him has been Laurie, who is the author, who's well done out of sight, just as a, you know, surprise intro. The author of the collection Stories for Nighttime and Some for the Day, and A Picture Book for Children, The Baseball Player and the Walrus. His stories have appeared in The New Yorker, Tin House, Reed Magazine, and Fairy Tale Review, been heard on This American Life and Select Shorts, and performed live at Word Theater in Los Angeles and London, a graduate of Harvard University and the American Film Institute MFA program. In screenwriting, Laurie lives in Los Angeles, where he's an instructor for the UCLA Extension Writers Program. So after both of their very long bios, I'll just read one review quote about the new book, Dr. Benjamin Franklin's Dream America, who Jim Rulin says is strangely moving and hugely compelling. It shattered my thinking as to what a novel can be and do, nothing less than an alternate history of the birth of the United States that hints at our coming demise. So here they are.
Is it on now?
Yes.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for coming. So Damien's going to start by reading a couple bits from the book. Do I need to introduce this? Would you like to give a little explanation of what this is? Or do you just want to jump in?
I'll just jump in.
Okay, perfect.
So if you don't know, the book takes place at the deaths of each of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. So each chapter is, you know, the guy's name who died. Caesar Rodney, June 29th, 1784. Through the layered films of Caesar Rodney's veil, only the general shape of his face can be seen. Slightly translucent, the veil hangs from the front of his skull, tucked into the collar of his shirt, so not even his neck is visible. He wears the veil to hide the fact that beneath it his face is falling off. Has been since just before the first Congress. His sister has never seen what remains of Caesar Rodney's face because he wears the veil all the time, even while he sleeps. They've been locked alone together inside this house since the first days of the second outbreak. Flesh pieces hang in the veil. His damp breathing haunts each and every stillness he can manage to carve out. Until about a week ago, Caesar Rodney would spend each day in the top veranda of his mansion, musket in hand. The wind would kick up and his veil would flatten to the jagged remnants of his face. Then the wind would change and the veil would billow, making his head look lopsided and swollen. Throughout all his watches, no one has ever tried to get on the property. In fact, neither of them has seen another soul since the second outbreak began. It was then that Caesar Rodney took all their computers and all their smart devices too and smashed them to pieces with a wood axe. He promised his sister he would never let the death get her, that he would keep the internet away, kill any intruder with no hesitation, with no questions asked. How am I supposed to meet anyone, his sister asked. How am I supposed to fall in love if we don't have the internet? His voice comes from beyond the veil. But they're all dead, dead from the death. We're the only ones left. Perhaps you can settle for some fraternal love, the love of your brother. She looks at chunks of dried skin dangling. If everyone's dead, brother, then why do we bother guarding the house? We guard the house because when this outbreak is over, there'll be another outbreak, and then one after that. And the only way to survive is to keep away from people and to keep off the internet forever. These challenges to his reasoning would have never crossed her lips even a week ago, but Caesar Rodney's sister has grown bold these last few days as her brother's health has taken a dramatic turn for the worse. It started with a light cough that spiraled into a fit. Now his mobility has been reduced to bed to fireside to dinner table to bed. The fits have become a regular occurrence. After each one, more and more pieces of Caesar Rodney's face can be seen lodged in the tangles of the veil. The sounds his lungs make are infested with an almost musical discord. Since that first fit, Caesar Rodney's sister has taken over the guard duty in her disinterested way. She sits up there for hours on end, leaning on the loaded musket, but all she ever sees is the road up to the mansion, empty and overgrown and full of shadows. The little village in the valley is as still as one of those frozen images back in the abandoned cloud. Maybe he's right, she thinks. Maybe there is no one left. And in a few days he'll be gone too, and I'll be the last human in the universe, all by myself. Then I'll check the internet. But she can't wait that long. After helping her brother to bed that evening, she lays awake in their shared room, cursing the death in her mind in rounds. Brother, she finally says, do you think that maybe my online profile has fallen in love at least? She listens to the staggered, gurgling wheeze of his breath. We'll get the death solved and go back online someday, and I'll find my profile taken over by a drone. Some low-level AI that was coded to adjust its programming and according to how many likes it gets on posts containing certain word combinations. Accepted a friend request one day, and it was an ad drone, programmed to collect as many friends as possible. Profile pictures some plump little hussy in a low-cut gown. Now they're writing posts all over each other's walls because they always hit their feedback criteria just right. The ends of their programming all tangled together, hard to tell which is which, working on the same equations, breaking down code the exact same way, whatever it is drones and love do. In the quiet that follows, she realizes her brother isn't asleep. He is moving in that bed, but not answering. She gets up and lights a candle and takes it with her to his bedside. This close, his breath sounds drenched, rattling up from the deep to pop mucus bubbles somewhere behind his teeth. The veil lays gently over his face, moving only slightly as he dies. It occurs to her then that she hasn't seen his face in years. Slowly, avoiding even the slightest contact with his flesh, she lifts away the veil. Some strained tendons, some chunks of dried meat, some cartilage and bone, a few tentacles of hair have matted themselves into flat tangles in a dried-out crust. But there certainly isn't any face. She leaves him there like that, makes her way slowly through the house, the place a person would sink in water if they let loose all their breath and held it. She gets to the kitchen. She realizes she is holding her breath, has to take a deep inhale which smells so fresh it shocks her. Been sleeping in that sour room with him for so long. From behind the bottom bookshelf in the pantry, under a loose board, she takes out an old junky laptop she has kept hidden from him all this time. Even though it's been a few days since Caesar Rodney has moved more than the length of a room at any one time, his sister is suddenly terrified that he'll appear in the kitchen doorway behind her, somehow suppressing his wheeze, negotiating the entire house without a noise to catch her running, ruining their only chance for survival. Well, she says, the death or no the death, and she presses the laptop's power button and waits, swears then that she can feel something unraveling in the air, as if the layers of this and a separate, untapped reality have started to mix. She flexes her fingers over the keys and watches the screen come to life. And this is the death of Thomas Lynch, February 13th, 1795. Thomas Lynch and his wife sailed away from America right when the revolution went from talking and signing things to a real goddamn war. Because who wants to be around for something like that if it's not your government demanding money and sons and requisitioning your livestock and your crops, then it's the army, the enemy's army doing the same thing, and then burning the whole farm down to boot, and raping women and smashing babies and torturing grown men to death. An army on a rampage through the countryside is not a pretty sight. The whole thing makes Thomas Lynch sick is what it does. Just plain sick. So it was out to live in the ocean until things settled down. They were able to follow the war online for a little while, but when word came through that the death was transmittable through the internet, they threw all the computer equipment right off the plank. The death, his wife said, watching their laptops and smartphones sink into the ocean in blackness. It was the first time they'd lived off the grid, the first time long-term on the ocean, too. It turned out to not be so bad. Instead of checking email, they checked the breezes. For feeds, they had each other's eyes. Bed was like a water bed, even though there was no water in it. On clear nights, they'd climb from the cabin to watch the stars shift above the Earth and the Milky Way hurtled into new stretches of the universe. It was a few years before they got their first pangs of curiosity about what was happening back on the mainland, and so they sailed in toward the shore, found a coastline abandoned, ships left bobbing in the low water, towns like frozen captures of towns deserted, no sign of the war or either army. Thomas Lynch checked some old-fashioned maps and charts. He looked at a compass and told his wife they were maybe off the coast of one of the Carolinas. They trolled southward until a small refugee camp opened up with a cannon fire, forcing them back into the ocean. America sure looked worse than the America they'd grown up in, and that was under British rule. A year or so later, they went in toward the shore again, and there wasn't any shore. It was just more sea, despite what the charts and maps and compasses said. Then the continent was suddenly there. Not they drew close and it came into view, or like a fog lifted. But it just appeared, the entire coast all at once, and only 100 yards from the bow, and high atop the closest crags, a dark-clad witch stood with arms spread, spells streaming from her fingers, making waving colors of the land that stretched out before her. And so off they went again, out to sea in the swelling storms and glassy windless days. Nothing as far as the sun could shine, just the two of them, and the slaves, and all the fish they could eat. This was their own private America. They could make it however they wanted, imagine it, and then create it, and then live inside it. All right there in the boat, the two of them, and the slaves. A few months later, they got curious again, maybe even a little homesick, and so they swung an arc in towards the shore just to see what was happening in everybody else's America. But all they saw were piles of bodies and nothing else. The next time they sailed in close, the bodies were still there, but now being loaded onto flying saucers which tilted and wobbled and then slipped through gaseous portals that tore open in the sky. The next time it was a whole fleet of saucers with spikes and tubes stuck into the ocean and black sludge in the water for weeks after. "Gosh," Thomas Lynch said to his wife, "everybody else's America looks like it sure sucks a big dick." His wife smiled. "But Thomas, do you know what sucked the biggest dick ever?" He looked at her blankly. "Martha Washington." And you could see it in their smiles, the love it would take to live this way. Back out, they sailed into the endless churning of the sea. Finally, on their most recent trip in, America looked kind of like the America they'd always imagined it could be, ships clogging the bay with commerce. A bustling port town beyond, church bells pealing so loud you could just see the goofy smile on the guy yanking the rope. But as they drew close, several open fires came into view, burning the streets. Lynch sailed alongside a schooner and asked what was happening, and the captain told him the people were burning the Federalists in effigy. "What's a Federalist?" Thomas Lynch wanted to know. "Cabal of trust fund babies and merchants that's taking control of the government." But what about George Washington? Can't he stop them? Washington is the leader, the most powerful Federalist there is. So maybe that was it then that sucked the biggest dick ever. And so off they went, back into the sea, because who wants to live in an America run by Federalists, whatever that is? But the worst thing they've ever seen was just one day ago, sun beating down on them, and not a fish in the sea. Food stores empty for the third day straight. Thomas Lynch and some of the slaves got a flash of hope when they looked out over the side of the boat at the first school of fish in weeks. But it wasn't any school of fish. No, this was all one fish, changing textures and reflecting bits of daylight when its parts came closest to the surface. For 5 minutes it swam beneath them. When finally the ocean had gone back to just ocean, a man floated to the top. They fished him out and he was dead all right, dead and drained of blood. They had to try to eat him, they didn't have any choice. And what are they going to do, starve on principle? But they started cooking him, he cracked and he burned like wood and got so hard to chew it was like eating wood chips. It was some dry meat. A storm came that night, the swells dropping them into watery caverns and then lifting them up so the endlessness of the ocean could come crushing in. They held hands and decided this is the event they would not survive, but here they are the next morning, and the ocean calm, and they're just as alive as the day they left. 16 years it's been. A rumbling under the boat gets everybody rushing out of their cabins. Thomas Lynch looks over the side and sees a little bit of that thing that's not a school of fish. And when he looks up, something huge and fleshy is lashing down towards him. He thinks, is that a tentacle? It wraps him up, and it's the last thing he sees, the tentacle, real close. is translucent enough that he can make out where the sun is through the flesh, but that's about all. A tint of blue sky, some fluid that must be running through the muscles of the tentacle. Can't breathe, but he doesn't have time to suffocate. Little pins come piercing from the tissue all around him, and suddenly he feels cold, cold, and bloodless.
So, I'm really happy to be here tonight. We're here because this has just been published by Nightshade, which is an American press, but it was published before in 2014 by a foreign press, an English press, I think. And I remember reading it back then because my friend Jim Ruland, at the end of every year, he puts up a list of everything he read this year and what he liked and didn't like. And I always read his list because he has great taste. And he was talking about this book, Dr. Benjamin Franklin's Dream America. And I remember just seeing that name and being like, wait, what? What? Having to read the name a couple times and being like, he was just raving about this book. So I was like, okay, I gotta read this book. And I remember ordering it because you couldn't just go to the store and buy it. And it came in like a package from Prague. From Prague. It was shipped to me, to my house from Prague. I remember, and I sat down and opened it. And all I knew going in was that it was in 56 chapters, and each chapter was the death scene of one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. I remember starting to read, and I was like, I mean, that's a cool idea, and I started to read, and then I was like, oh, this is weird, like, they have the internet. They have the internet, that's weird, and I was like, oh, that's kind of fun. And then people start getting sick because there's some plague called the death that seems to be coming out of the internet and infecting and killing people. At the same time that they're beginning the Revolutionary War against England, suddenly everyone begins to die because the internet is infecting them. I'm like, oh, this is not a book I usually read. And then around page 40, the aliens appeared. And I was like, okay, this is a book for me, you know? And then it doesn't end there. You know, like every time you begin to sort of have a handle on what's going on in this book, it just keeps mutating, keeps more things. Like after that, there's a curse, a witch curses the United States. And then people begin to move into there's kind of like a Facebook virtual reality kind of thing, Dr. Benjamin Franklin's Dream America. People start to participate in democracy through the internet. And then people start to move into the internet. And then the internet becomes haunted. And then the sea monster appears. And like there's just, every time you begin to settle down, it just gets crazier and crazier. And anyway, I just love this book. And I was just so baffled that someone had written this book. I just like literally could not believe someone wrote this book. Usually I pick up a book, especially, you know, a novel, and I read the first chapter and I'm like, yeah, okay. Like I get it, you know, I can see how this is gonna go. But I just could not conceive of how this happened. So this is my first question. How did this happen? Like I can see sitting down to write about the signers of the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, that was the first thing, was the sort of conceit of doing that as the novel. I thought it was like a funny, it amused me, you know, I kind of like felt reckless and funny to like pursue, almost like something you would think of or like say drunk at a party that you were going to do, but then to actually do it makes it even funnier. And it just had this kind of like, I love the idea of that art, that as an art project. Okay, well, let's see if that's even possible. And at the same time, I really loved history, loved the American Revolution, loved that world, and think it's weirdly science fiction and dark already, even if it's just how it is. And loved sci-fi and stuff, and I just kind of put all those interests into one thing. I kind of almost was like three novels that I was thinking about writing became like the same novel. And so then once those collisions came, it just picked up its own gravity and it sort of took off from there.
Was there like a moment, was there like a night where you were sitting there and it was like, 3 a.m, and some they're like, fuck it, I'll just throw them all together?
Yeah, it's funny. There's a spot that I was walking my dog in Washington, D.C., and I still remember that spot as the place where I was like, really thought, because in my head, really, it was as simple as like, am I going to write that as the next thing, or am I going to write this like you know, gothic, epic sci-fi thing that takes place in, like, colonial America. It takes place in some kind of past that has some kind of future wrapped up in it, too. And then when I was like, oh my god, I could just have that be this, you know? And then all of a sudden, it wasn't just, like, a gimmick that was going to be, like, an experimental framework to just retell, like, the American Revolution in a very dramatic way. All of a sudden, it had this, like, extra sci-fi twist. And then what you're talking about with, like, every, like, 20 pages of getting, like, something else wild coming into it, I think once that was the opening conceit of, like, well, I'm not saving any ideas left, it became this thing of, like, well, once you're, like, 50 pages in, there's monsters and aliens and stuff, just, like, you throw the anchor, boat tilts sideways, and you just fire all the cannons, you know, it's, you get it lined up.
Yeah. I just write, like, very, very short stories, and it's already confusing as hell, and I can't keep track of anything, like, how did you, do you have like a map to your book?
Yeah, I had this spreadsheet. It was an Excel spreadsheet, and it had all the guys, all their dates and births and deaths, a big section of notes, links, like the place they died. And then it also had like, followed some, one of the storylines, you know? There's multiple storylines that go through it that kind of intertwine and whatnot. And it sort of became important to just like make sure that it didn't vanish for 150 pages, you know, you could get it in there just enough to keep it alive. And so that helps too, to see like, okay, I haven't mentioned it in like six guys, so, you know, sorry, your story is going to have to be about this, man.
Yeah. Did you know all these people? I was really surprised, like there's 56 signers, and I was really surprised by how few of them I had ever heard of, you know? Like, there were like maybe five. It's like John Hancock and Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and the Adamses. Thinking everyone else, I'm like, I've never heard of them in my whole life.
Yeah, there's some you come across. Like, I had read a lot of this already. I wasn't, like, new to the American Revolution when I started writing it. So, like, if you read a biography of Adams and Hancock and Washington and Jefferson, you know, certain guys are going to show up a ton of times. And then you're eventually going to know who they are. And there's probably a biography of, like, half of them or something. Mm-hmm. That some of them are, like, written by the cousin of, you know, the distant relative of the person to try to like keep their legacy alive, and it's tedious because the guy's boring.
Yeah.
And the most exciting thing they ever did was that, and it was like 100 times more exciting than anything else they ever did in their life. But they were in there, you know, and so I did sort of know like half of them, but yeah, there's a bunch that were total blanks, and some that you're excited to show other people because you're like, oh, there's this weird guy with like a real dirty mouth, and let's bring him to life on the page here.
Is that the guy who got killed by the Indian?
No, he was didn't have a dirty mouth. He was just kind of a boring guy, so his story did become kind of absorbed by the plot. But he did get sent out by George Washington to go like talk to the Indians and to sign a treaty with them because he was there. You know, he had signed the Declaration of Independence and he's hanging around in Georgia, I believe. Washington's like, who we got to Georgia to go talk to these Indians? And so they sent Lyman Hall up there, and I think he got sick or something on the way and died because of it, but I don't think, like, he didn't get killed by the Indians.
Right. My favorite in the book that I'd never heard of was Francis Hopkinson. In the book, he's sort of like this mastermind who, he's a coder, and he's the one who creates this Dr. Benjamin Franklin's Dream America, which is this, like, online marvel that changes everything. But then when he dies, he like appears in the internet and is a ghost in the internet. But I'd never heard of him. Is he somebody I should have heard of?
No, I mean, he didn't do, like, I mean, yeah, maybe, I don't know. The things that he did that I thought were super interesting was he was like a poet and like a musician, kind of, more than like a lawyer or a politician or like a surveyor. He designed the American flag, like the first American flag, and then when they would like need money, they would be like, oh yeah, give it to Francis Hopkinson to do it. He's like the art nerd, you know, in the Congress. And I just thought he was really cool, and he did a lot of those kinds of things. He wrote like a lot of patriotic songs and like, you know, other more arty stuff than just like pop stuff. But, you know, I think it's cool that he was like a musician and kind of a like graphic designer. And to design money, it sounds like, oh, it's just like the money, but it, you know, it has to be both functional and kind of like aesthetically pleasing and stuff. And so it's an interesting kind of like thing that became his gig throughout the American Revolution, was like when they needed like a new splash page.
Francis Hopkinson. Wow. I was also, I mean, it really brought home. I was rereading it today, and it just really brought home to me like how little I know about American history. Like, I don't even really understand how these guys came to sign the Declaration of Independence. Like, who appointed these people?
Yeah, it's different. It's different kind of state to state, I think. But, you know, mostly they're representatives from their state. And some states would send 5, and some states would send 2 or 6. And, you know, I think, like, Massachusetts would send 6 because there were, like, 6 people that were owed favors kind of thing, you know? There's, like, 3 guys who were, like, charismatic or something, and then these... Got to get the Western guys in there, so send somebody out. Send some jerk from West Boston over here to balance things out, get everybody on board. And then it was a second Congress, so they had one Congress already, which is where they like made Washington in charge of the army and whatnot. And then, you know, they had a second Congress, and it was mostly half the same guys and some other new guys. And it was the second Congress that passed the bill, you know, for the independence, and the guys who were there at the time signed it. And it's weird, like, not they didn't all sign it at once. Some of it was like years later. Like, Thomas McKean didn't sign for years later because he had gone out to fight in a war, but like wanted his name on it. And so, like, waited and finally got his chance and kind of signed his name on the bottom. So it's basically like, you know, as if, you know, whose names are on the Obamacare bill. It's like who was in Congress at the time.
And George Washington was not a signer.
Right, because he was gone off into the war, wasn't in the second Congress. He was a representative from Virginia first. And then, yeah, he's off fighting the war. A bunch of guys, you know, went off to fight, so... Really, by the second Congress, it's mostly politicians.
So they were appointed by their states. I'm sorry, I know I'm just a stupid person. They're appointed by their states.
Yeah.
When they go to sign it, is it already decided that they are going to sign, or are they making decisions on their own?
A little mix of both. Like, you know, there would be home votes. Like, some county and somewhere would, like, vote to, like, have their guy vote a certain way, and they would kind of follow it sometimes, or they might get recalled if they didn't. But there was also factions, too. So, like, the guy Caesar Rodney, who I read, he was famous for, if you get a, you know, the quarters that have the state, every state on it, if you get the Delaware one on the back, there's a picture of a guy riding a horse, because Delaware had sent 3 representatives, and one guy was against independence, and one guy was for it, and Caesar Rodney was for it. And so they needed, he wasn't there, and so they needed him to be there to cast a tie-breaking vote for Rhode Island, because it was, like, state by state, so, like, you got a majority in a state, it counted as 1. And so there's like, you know, 2 for it in Rhode Island, and Delaware, and 1 against. And so Caesar Rodney like rides through the night on this horse through a storm to get there to cast the tie-breaking vote to like swing Delaware in. And then because Delaware is in, it's like a majority, and then a couple other states fall in. So he's famous. You have to ride his horse through a storm to get there to like break the tie.
Wow. And who is deciding who, like who is electing those people to go?
I mean, it depends. I think some guys were elected and some guys were appointed, you know. I think in Massachusetts it was mostly like wards, you know, and they would kind of elect somebody to go, and I think certain places would have, you know, business interests. It was similar now, like, you know, we kind of elect these people, but they're kind of also just someone's puppet, you know. They get money from somebody, and they represent something to the state, and so they get elected. And so, you know, Massachusetts sends like this, like the pretty boys of the revolution, you know, your Hancock and John Adams and Sam Adams and stuff. And then they get this, you know, Robert Treat Paine, who's just some lawyer. And then they get, you know, this other guy who represents some small city. So they get those guys happy. And it was a similar way to how Washington becomes the general of the army. It was, you know, they're throwing a bone to like another place. You know, Massachusetts is kind of running the show. And they're like, if we make John Hancock in charge of the army, it's going to seem like a Massachusetts show. So like, let's get this guy over here from the west to the south. Similar to how they'd build the Congressional Congress, you know, they'd have somebody who represents different parts, and they would kind of all get the full support of the state by who they picked or elected.
All right. So the other thing that this I noticed reading it again, you know, is that things have really changed since the first time I read this. 2014, and I feel like it sort of mirrors, I mean, just the coming of the internet. I feel like everybody went through this experience, you know, when the internet first appeared, and everyone learns about email, and then like there's this period where everyone like, oh my god, email, this is amazing. This is like the greatest thing, and you would get an email, and you'd be super happy. Then you got an email, and you got to send an email, and And then over time, you get kind of used to it, and then at some point, it's just the worst thing in the world to get an email. You know, it was like really cool when like a Friendster appeared, and then like MySpace. It was still fun, and then at some point, like social networking just became like a very heavy experience. It started to drag everybody down, and I feel like that's sort of where I was when I first read it. And then over the past year or so, the internet seems to have become just like the devil, you know, just like destroyed everything. But I feel like maybe you were already there at that point when you wrote the book. Were you, like, what was your, do you remember the point when the internet like became bad, or was it always threatening to you?
I just knew that it would, you know, it's like a cycle. Like, I started writing it in 2007, and it was like, Barack Obama was just kind of this dude that nobody had heard of, really. He was just starting to run for president, and you remember his, not him and him as a guy, but like that he was that first person that sort of had an internet presence in his campaign. Remember the statistic that was really eye-opening then was in 2008, YouTube was as big as the entire internet had been in 2004. So in one presidential election cycle, you know, the internet is like growing exponentially, and all of a sudden this one piece of the internet is bigger than the whole thing used to be the last time we had a presidential election. And just thinking like, well, it's not too long until this goes wrong, you know, this can't, this is bound to be some thing, you know, it's true of any industry in America, it's everything's kind of cyclical in a certain sense. You know, something becomes great and they're like, oh, this is, look at these trends and stuff, and then, you know, you get pollution or whatever, good and bad comes of it, and there's like this great awesome connectivity with the internet, and then of course people are going to get tired of it or start to do something sick with it, and yeah, we'll get exhausted. But also what will also happen is that we'll age, and it'll just, we'll get sick of it because we're too old, you know, like the future kind of is like, I think half the people alive always see now as like some kind of creepy future that has arrived too soon, you know, and it's like, and that's just the nature of aging, you know, it's the best fad going. Everybody's doing it.
Yeah. Were you an early adopter? Were you on the internet soon?
No, you know, I'm not like a big computer guy. I can sit at a computer and, you know, use a couple shortcut keys and stuff, but I don't do a ton of it, and I don't really like texting and stuff like that. I don't care either way about it. I don't hate it. But yeah, I'm not super into it, but I'm into like the alternate reality of it. I think that that's always something that's really interesting. And you know, the internet is the alternate reality of the moment, of choice. So yeah, I got interested in just like video games, just like thinking about that, but I never play them. I like to probably spend more time like thinking about how cool these massive multiplayers are than I ever spend playing. I've never played one even, but I sit there and sometimes I just think for an hour at a time, like, wow, that must be so weird. Maybe I should actually play it.
You never played video games, really?
Like after Super Mario Brothers, yeah, not really. I got to this point when we were like playing James Bond, and you'd like turn on the thing, and somebody else would kill you in 5 seconds, and that's not fun anymore.
So did you have like computer people who you talked to get all the stuff right in the book? It seems like it's written by someone who really knows computers.
I just think a lot of that seems that way because it's made up. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you land on a certain vocabulary set or a tone, and then you just like stick with it enough that it seems like it's based on something. When in reality, it's just kind of like made up based on kind of how we talk, but like with a slight variation.
Do you have an idea of where everything is going?
No.
Yeah, you have like a worst fear?
No, but I think Match is going to be like the biggest company in like 30 years. Like the company that has all the like dating algorithms. They own all the software for that. A, because it's like this crazy AI that's able to like match humans based on, you know, alterable criteria. And like that just seems to me some recipe for some innovation that I haven't thought of yet that could be scary. Whether it's like things you see in like Minority Reports, tracks your eye and all of a sudden knows what to sell you. I mean, if it's able to match people up to make them fall in love, can't it just make you fall in love with a pair of shoes or something too? Then also think what's going to happen when like people who are like 30 now or like 70 and like they're widows and stuff, they're going to be getting on that thing with Viagra and banging the hell out of the place, these old folks' homes, with Tinder and Viagra. So if you buy it now, match now, by the time the like next round of like born, raised with the internet get elderly, you're gonna start raking it in.
All right, make a note of that. All right, let's see, what else? Oh, now I'm blanking. There was my other big question. Where did it go? Oh yeah, I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about how this book got published and then republished, which is something I don't know that, I guess it's happened once before that I know.
In the history of the world.
Yeah. You're number two, how does that feel?
Great. Been number two my whole life.
What was it like sending this book out to begin with?
You know, I didn't a lot. Yeah. I had failed to like write a couple novels before this and short story collections and or really get much of anything published or anyone to like do anything except slide it into the trash barrel. And in the process of writing the novel, I had gotten in touch with these guys through like a friend of a friend who run an experimental anthology of experimental fiction and film criticism and poetry and art. They were publishing them once a year out of Prague. And I got hooked up into that, and I would give them something every time they published one. And then they asked one time, and the only thing I had was the first chapter of this. And I was about ready to finish like a first draft, and they published that. And then said, like, send us this manuscript when it's done. We have a press, too, and we like it. And so I kind of, like, played it a little soft, and I really wanted it to be good at the time. And I sent them it when it was done, and they liked it. And while they were kind of, like, thinking about maybe publishing, I did send it to some agents and places and just got no response whatsoever. And so after maybe sent like, a little while, I sent it to them, they wanted to publish it. So I just kind of did it. I didn't really have this big, broad submission process where I had no agent or anything. And then it took them like another 6 months or something to do it. And they weren't gonna edit it at all. And I remember thinking like, either I should be like super proud or like very scared. And so I like undertook this whole like edit of my own that like I just really tried to like give it an extra little bit because I knew it really wasn't ready to be published. and then once that was published, that's how everything else happened. Like I read it when it first came out at something here in LA that Jim Rulin's reading, and Scott read it and passed it along to his agent, and his agent became my agent, and then that agent sold it to Skyhorse. Here we are.
And what was that process like? I mean, is it strange to sell a book that you've already had published before? I mean, was that a concern of theirs?
I don't know. It's like asking someone who's a twin what it's like to be a twin, you know? Yeah. I don't know, just like to get it published seemed like this huge, the first time seemed like this huge accomplishment, but then everything else was like someone called me, mm-hmm. you know, which I thought was such a strange reversal, and I think that probably everybody who publishes something kind of goes through that, where it's like, you can't get anybody to like, even give you the time of day, and then like, all of a sudden like an agent calls me and wants to like, do it, and like, and then he's convincing me, it's like, you should have just said, asked me, I would like a three-word question, like, will you let me try to sell this? Yeah. Didn't need to be an hour-long sales job. I was pretty desperate.
And was there an editing process then, or did they just...
No, they just copy-edited it. Yeah, I found the typos. Wow.
And what was the process with the cover, too? I remember reading, this was the original cover. I don't know if you can see this. It's just the signers of the Declaration with X's over their faces. I remember this was just like a terrifying cover. Can you talk a little bit about that? Both of the covers?
Sure, so the first cover I designed, Equus Press, who published it, just asked me if I had any ideas for a cover, and I thought, yeah, like, I thought that would be cool, and so it's Trumbull's painting of the signing, and I was able to download, like, a real high-def version of one of those files that you put into Photoshop, and then it just, like, makes your computer, like, run in slow motion, it's so huge, and then I just went through with the thing, and I use the spray can feature. This is all just like stuff you learn in like freshman dorm when you're messing with Photoshop while you're drinking or something. And it was like spray can function over these guys' faces. And then you can see there's like a layer of matrix, you know, the binary code in the background. I just dropped that in over it. And I did, I was trying to aim for, it was definitely more like leaning into the sort of like gothic horror tone of the novel, because mm-hmm. it has a couple mix-up tones. And then in The new publishing guys, they actually hired an artist. I thought it came out really cool. It's like, it goes for a little bit more of the like internet mixed with colonialism tone.
Yeah.
Which is probably a better sales job.
Yeah, when I saw the new cover, I was like, oh, it's like an alternative history.
Right.
I guess it is, I guess, an alternative history, but I'd never seen it before, and I think it was because of that cover.
But the alternative history usually will be like, what if, like, Robert E. Lee wins the Civil War? But this is basically everything the same happens, except it just has a different sort of setting a little bit, I guess.
Yeah. A lot of different settings. A lot of different pieces to that setting. Yeah. All right, well, shall we open it to questions? Does anyone have any questions?
Did you, am I right, that you initially had this online as like its own kind of website where some topics that you did about social different stories?
No, that was another thing that I wrote, yeah, that I put online that way. It was like a collection of flash fiction, but it wasn't really a collection, it was just every piece of flash fiction I wrote over the course of like 3 years while I was working at this bookstore outside, and I would like watch these crazy people come to this outdoor book flea market and like pick up books and like just stare at them long enough until some idea came into my head and write these little tiny pair of short things about them. Not about them, but whatever it was. And it was all kind of set in DC, and it was all kind of like weird little short flash fiction. It's much more like something that you would write than like this. And I just could never get any traction with it. People would read it and like it, but it was kind of unpublishable in some certain sense. So I really got into like early, like, what was that Adobe program, Dreamweaver. It was just like fun to make those things. And so I made like this kind of portal for it that was like all prime numbers and you could click and the different stories would open. But it was a different thing, but yes, I did have that online at some point. Yeah, that flash fiction thing ended up beginning with my mind for like so many other things, like scripts and other stories and like published little pieces of it. It was good thought. It was like good to have around, you know, like some old trash, old shirt to wear if you got stuck.
What did you have in the Lady Rosebud's?
Lady Churchill's
Lady
Rosebud.
Lady Churchill's Rosebud. That's the Kelly Link magazine, right?
Yeah, yeah. And Gavin Grant, right? It was this story about this sort of alternate world where everything just like sinks through this endless tunnel. And it's basically in that setting, it's sort of like feudal Japan a little bit, you know, it's like these disconnected little villages. And it was kind of like a wandering samurai story set in that world.
Wow. All right.
Were the founders' deaths, I can't remember, were they the legitimate dates of when those people actually died that you used in the book, or did you fictionalize to try to group them together?
No, yeah, it was all accurate to the day of their deaths. Was another thing that I'm early to go back to your first question, like early on, like I really loved the conceit of that. But there was a moment in my head where I remember thinking like, I should do the Constitution because I think there's only like 36 of those guys. So that's gonna be like you know, a third less work. But then you know, like anything when you're trying to think of that first kind of thing to launch you into like a big art project, you start to look at the signers, and if you really are gonna follow it along, the beautiful thing that happens is that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams are like second and third to last, so it gives you the ending and then one more guy for like the coda. And so you get the two biggest people that are the most famous guys that have signed it and the biggest characters of anybody who have the biggest stories last to the end and die on the same day, exactly 50 years after the signing. It's just like, oh, well that has to be. That's a perfect structure is already there for that, you know? And I remember just thinking like, oh, it's just so great that it wound up that way for me.
Yeah. No, it's great to have so many because you get like the sort of spine of the story of the country, all the things that are going on. But then within that, because every chapter is only like 3 or 4 pages, you get sort of little tastes of other things. You know, there's like sort of comic relief chapters and scarier chapters, and kind of, I feel like it would be less with fewer chapters. It would be more just sort of plot point by plot point.
Yeah, having them be the real dates too, like, made you have sometimes like 3 years missing in the story, which then would like make you have to fill in the blanks in a way that kept everything alive. And so it almost like forced its own tension between them because of the time and the strictness of that format. I always said it was like a great thing to launch the book because it had a format and a structure that was there. But then once I was revising it, it was so inflexible. Because once I had done it, I didn't want to like mess up the dates and be like, oh, I'll just throw that all that work away. And it also makes the conceit, I think, a little bit funnier that they actually stick to the dates.
Was there ever a point where you were tempted to cheat, to lie about a date?
No. There were times when you're just like, ah, that guy's not the right guy for this moment, and I can't change it, and I need to somehow make it. So sometimes I would like make a guy on the other side of the political side than he was because it needed to be that right then. Mm-hmm. You know, basically the equivalent of like, you know, making John McCain a Democrat 100 years from now, and people would be like, well, I don't know, it's not part of the story, just don't worry about him. But didn't really move anything or really want to move anything other than that. The one that I read about the guy who disappeared at sea was always a good one because he did vanish at sea, and so like no one really knew when he died. And so I remember thinking like, I'm going to put that somewhere where I need something. And then once I thought of the idea of him swooping back in on the boat, I'm like, okay, the next time I need to just tell Gilbert, like, all right, chill out everyone, here's what's happened so far. Aliens and the witches and the monsters now here. And it was always going to be like a slidable set. But other than that, yeah, I stuck pretty close to it and never had to really make too many big lies.
You've created, I think, in here like a really obviously unique world, right? With the, you know, the internet existing and a play going through it. Have you thought about building it out at all and sort of continuing stories of other people that exist in this one?
Not the same exact setting, but I do think that like there's other similar conceits in me somewhere, you know, like I don't know if it's like, you know, I always thought it would be cool, I've never been able to come up with a good enough idea to like tell a story through the like Supreme Court justice deliberations, where they sit around and by seniority they go around the room and give their opinion on a case. Like, that would be cool if you could figure out a way to like, each guy's story is like a chapter and you have 9 chapters and it tells the story of something, you know, and has some history in it and throw in a time travel or something. So I don't think there would be a, you know, like a sequel, but I think I'd maybe do the same kind of thing again. It's really fun.
Yeah.
What are you working on now?
I'm doing mostly TV and film writing now. Like, I've got super lucky, like, right after publishing the novel to kind of get a couple jobs in a row and have been working steadily at that and not had really a lot of time to, like, super dedicate to fiction. But can't not mess around with it a little bit here and there, so I don't really have a good answer. Just toying around at this point, you know, typing up pages and putting them in files.
What are the TV and movies?
I did a bunch of adaptations of these books. I got one and then I just kind of got a string of them. There are two sort of westerns. One's a Civil War western and one's like a western. And then a horror novel, you know, Brian Evanson, who's a local horror guy, adapted one of his stories into a screenplay. I wrote for the OA, the TV show The OA. So yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
And did you get that because of the book? How did that happen?
Which, any of them?
The first one, whatever came first.
Kind of. I think maybe the book made people take me a little more seriously, or like at least be like, okay, like this is a guy who also has a book. It's slightly different, but I don't know if it helped too much. What I'd done is like, I'd always wanted to write for movies and make films and stuff, and I just sort of somehow got onto writing a novel first. And when I finished the novel, I really did want to, like, get back into, like, I'd done all these, like, stupid movie projects, like, more, like, an art installation kind of stuff. I really wanted to be, like, all right, I want to write, like, a real movie. And so I instantly just, like, changed lanes and was like, oh, this is so fun, it's a different format, wrote a couple scripts, and then I came to town with those and was able to get representation and sell one. And I don't know, I think the novel did help in a certain sense, just it's, like, it helped definitely more than that way than financially, you know. It's just like a business, it's like a really elaborate business card that I could give to somebody.
Was there a
hand out there? The idea of the book is scary because it's talking about how like technology could exist, could have existed, and what could have been the repercussions, even though the outcome is similar. Where we're going, I was reading this email that went around after the years about like the future and, you know, automated cars and like just like where we're going and the loss of jobs, and it's kind of mind-blowing. You just don't know what's actually going to become true or not. I'm curious if like predictions of the future scare you or not.
I think some of that stuff's a little scary, but I feel like we're going backwards or something. Like, you have this idea that like because of the internet, people are like leaving planet Earth and going into this alternate reality or something, but I feel like it ties you to the Earth so much more. Like, even 30 years ago, you know, you could just like, you had no idea where anybody was. Like, you could walk outside your house and like, you know, you could go into the woods or walk across town, and who knows, they would call and leave a message at your house. Maybe you'd come back that day or the next day and try to call them and magically get in touch with them while they happen to be at their house. But now, like, everybody can be found, like, so quickly. You're, like, so connected to and tied down to the Earth, and, like, you're not outside your body anymore. You're, like, confined in it by this, like, force field that comes out of this, like, radioactive thing in your pocket. Like, that doesn't seem like, you know, we're escaping anything. So I always think of it if it's, like, it almost feels like, I don't know, we're like counteracting what, like, for a long time it was like, oh my god, now you can send a person across the whole country in like 5 hours. And now it's like, I bet if you track those little people, they're not going too far on their phones, you know, and then it's just this, you could do a real sad video of like, show like how little each person like moves.
Yeah.
I guess it's a bit more.
Is it a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't know. It just seems like counterintuitive to me or something. You'd think there'd be like more freedom as opposed to like building a cage or something.
It's like when people talk about how people don't read anymore, but really everybody's reading constantly. It's just they're only reading Facebook updates.
Yeah, but like, I don't know, it's just like the disposability of it. You know, it makes me. I was always a big fan of like the huge, big novels. You know, like these thousand-page things. I just thought that was so cool, and it does make me a little sad or nervous or something. That now it really is like. Because I do the same thing. I haven't read like a whole article since, you know, 2003, 2004. You know, okay, headline. Give it. I'll just, you know, you need a little thing on your mouse or your screen. Just like one flick and see how much of it I can read, and then it's off. And I'm someone who likes that long stuff, and so I really wonder like how many people actually sit down and read a whole thing.
Although I did see recently, was this you, that you really liked the Alan Moore Jerusalem book?
Yeah,
that's
I like that.
4,000 pages or something.
Yeah, 1,200.
Yeah. That was so you're reading large books, you're just not reading on a computer screen?
Yeah, I don't like that. I can't like read a long time on the screen for some reason. Yeah, I mean, I'll read a long, long book. I mean, I don't read, like, thoroughly, though, like, the articles and newspapers anymore and that kind of thing. I've lost my attention span for that. But if I'm away from the internet and I have this huge novel, I can sit down and play and have a good time.
Yeah, I noticed that somewhere along the way I lost the password to my Washington Post, like, digital edition thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I never even tried to get it back. Just, like, the headline is enough at this point.
Yeah.
Question going back to the book. You said that for the one character, he died at sea, but nobody knew how. But he kind of disappeared. So you had an opportunity there to kind of take real history up to a point and then just create freely from there. For how many of them, or for most of them, or you know, not most of them, were you able to kind of use a lot of what was known about these guys and then find, you know, sort of periods of their life, things that happened where it wasn't known, and create there.
Yeah, I tried to stick to it as closely as possible. So, like, if some guy died in a certain way, if you had like famous last words, I tried to always get those in there. And tried to make them die very close to how they really died. You know, sometimes somebody grabs one of these alien crystals and like jumps into like a pit of lava, so like that's obviously not what happened. But like some guys did really, you know, guys really did die in duels. Some guy would like get like kidney stones, and that's kind of where I got the idea of like these aliens growing crystals inside of them. But try to take like what was true and make it just like just true enough so you could like hide the ball, you know, and get through it without it really being inaccurate. Sort of with the goal of like almost delivering like knit like popular history in a certain sense that you could read it and be like, oh, I learned as much from this book as I did from David McCullough's book. Except it was way cooler.
Is there any, if someone were to approach you and say, want you to adapt this for film or TV, because it is such a world, is there any, a rich world, is there any world in which you would do that?
Well, I just think the problem is it doesn't have like main characters, you know? And so you'd have to change it so much, it would probably be better just to like start over, you know, and be like, okay, well, we could do a movie set or a TV show set in the American Revolution with internet, but to follow too closely to the book, just like, it just doesn't make sense, because there's, unless you can figure out a way to make a show where there's different characters in every single episode. I get tired of watching people die every week, too. I mean, maybe.
I mean, I think you could do it, probably. You just have to focus on a couple. I mean, Francis Hopkinson is like the kind of the Neo
right.
of your book. You focus it around Hopkinson and probably Benjamin Franklin.
You could do it as an anthology series, too. It would actually be pretty cool, an anthology series. You've got the story, you know, I mean, you could adapt the book almost exactly, you know?
We can come to the meetings with you and say, yeah.
Yeah, bring everything. We got at least like 20 viewers.
All right, any other questions?
Well, thank you all for coming.
Yeah, thank you. Is there going to, oh, yes.
Yes, here I am. If you want to buy the book, you can do so at the register, and then we'll clear this off and we'll sign some books. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Skylight Books author reading series. Don't forget, you can listen to this and all of our other great podcasts at skylightbooks.com. Thanks again for stopping by, and we hope to see you soon.